very interesting when you look around the world and you look at communities everywhere. It's always problematic with people dividing into groups. First of all, there is harmony together, then they divide up into subgroups and they split up into various ways. And it's not just in the outside of Buddhism, this is happening inside of Buddhism as well. You see Buddhist groups around the world, there's always a certain degree of disharmony and problems. This is a very common human problem. Wherever you are in the world, whether you are in Australia, where I try to, usually am, except when I'm here or somewhere else, or anywhere else in the world. So the question is, when it's found everywhere, in all areas of the world, all parts of the world, then the question is it really possible to have harmony, right? If it is such an important kind of element, almost, of being human beings, how can we actually have harmony if it is such an ingrained aspect of who we are as human beings? And to understand this, there is the Buddhist teaching, of course, is very much, a large part of it is about harmony. The Pali word for harmony is samaggi or samagga, and it means coming together. It also means like unity, if you like it. And to understand whether it is possible how to be harmonious in the world, it is important to understand the conditions, the causes that give rise either to harmony or to disharmony. Once you understand the causes for these things, where it's come from, then you have a chance of dealing with the problem. Buddhist teaching is all about causality, right? Dependent origination, how one thing leads to something else. This is one of the foundation stones of the Buddhist teachings. And the reason why causality, of course, is so important in the Buddhist teaching is because, according to Buddhism, there is no essential thing that carries on through time. This is what the doctrine, the idea of anatta, of non-self, is all about. That then nothing is really carries on. And if nothing carries on, it means that everything is caused by something else. Everything is conditioned by something else. So what is the cause for disharmony? Right? Okay, so what is the cause for disharmony? The cause for disharmony, number one, is that we have different opinions about things, right? Once you have different opinions about things, you look at the world in a different way, then very often that leads, when you then have to come to a solution about something, you have to discuss something, often it leads to problems, it leads to disharmony because of that. So difference of opinions is often the cause for disharmony. Why do we have different opinions? How come we can't look at the world, everyone, in the same way, and then, you know, be happy about that? A bit like the Aryans, perhaps, the Arahants, who all have a roughly same idea of the world. Why is it that we can't be everyone like Arahants? And the reason is because we come from different backgrounds. Our conditioning is so different, right? Because our conditioning is different, because our background is different, because our past lives are different, because how we grew up is different, our teachers are different, all of these things. It means that when we look at the world, we don't look at the world in exactly the same way. Our minds are different. How we perceive things is going to be different. And when we perceive things differently, it is bound to be the case that we have disagreement in opinions. So what that means is that it is inevitable that we're going to disagree. We have to disagree. We should not try to find a solution where everybody agrees with everything else. It's impossible. So we have to expect disagreements. And if we try to suppress disagreement in the world, it just leads to a sense of being oppressed, right? Yeah, I don't want to listen to your opinion. I'm the majority. I'm stronger than you. So you do what I say. I'm going to suppress your disagreement with the situation. And that leads to problems. It leads to a sense of being oppressed by the people around you. So disagreement in the world is part and parcel of what it means to be human. You cannot avoid disagreement. It has to be. So the question is not how can we avoid disagreement. The question is how can we deal with disagreement in a skillful way so it doesn't lead to disharmony, it doesn't lead to argument, it doesn't lead to the community splitting up into subgroups, right? You have like BGF originally being a kind of one group and it splits up into sub little BGFs, you know, one group here, one group there, and everybody kind of, you know, dissipating. And if you split up too much in this way, it means you lose some of the strength of the Buddhist community because everybody wants to do their own thing. Everybody wants to be the leader. Everybody wants to go their own way. So the trick in Buddhist, according to Buddhism, is not so much to find out everybody can agree, but to find a way where we can disagree in a harmonious way. That is really what the kind of Buddhist ideal is all about. Disagreement is inevitable. Disharmony is not inevitable. And that is really the crucial issue here. And what is interesting about this, of course, the Buddha has a lot to say about these things. And one of the things that he says, which I always found very interesting, is that when a community is in disharmony and people are not working together properly, and people are maybe arguing, and maybe kind of attacking each other in various ways, in that sort of community, it becomes very difficult, even impossible, to practice the Buddhist teachings properly. Yes, and you know why? Because when you are in disharmony, when you're arguing with others, your mind is a bit in turmoil. You try to sit quietly and all the things, oh, they said that, she said that, he said that. Well, how can they say that to me, right? And this is how it goes on in your mind if there's disharmony in the community. But this is the problem. You can't really settle down. You can't meditate. It's difficult to be kind. It's difficult to have kind thoughts and all of these kind of things. So disharmony is problematic. In fact, the Buddha goes so far in the sutra. He says that if there is disharmony in the monastic community, meditation itself becomes impossible. You can't meditate properly, right? The whole path kind of disintegrates into nothing, and it doesn't work out anymore. But actually, it is quite important that we strive for a degree of harmony, whether it's in the monastic community, or it is in the lay community, or as a nation, or as a world, right? The whole globe should really be much more harmonious than we actually are. Work together to solve the big problems in the world. And there are so many massive problems in the world that need a solution. But then instead of actually finding a solution, we argue with each other instead. And this is part of the problem here. So what does the Buddha say about this? What is the solution? How can we actually find this harmony? And I was just on the retreat we were just having, I was talking a little bit about the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. You know the Mahaparinibbana Sutta? I don't know. Okay. This is the longest sutta in the Pali Canon. Really, really long. It goes over about 60 pages. And it is the sutta which talks about the Buddha's final passing away. And it talks about when the Buddha is on this trip from Rajagaha. Rajagaha is the ancient capital of the Magadha Empire, large empire in India at the time. And the Buddha walks from Rajagaha, and he walks north, crosses the river Ganges, through Vaisali, some of the large cities at that time. And then he ends up in Kushinara, where eventually he passes away. And this is the story of what happens to the Buddha as he is on this trip. And because it is the Buddha's last journey, the very last thing that he does, it is exceptionally interesting. Because you can imagine what the Buddha does on his last journey. What he does, he lays down those things that are the essence of his teachings. Now is the time to tell his disciples what really matters in Buddhism. They can keep on practicing these things afterwards, right? So very interesting. Maybe you think, oh, which sutta should I believe? Which monk should I believe? Okay, this here, you find it. Here is the essence of the Buddha's teachings. So what is that essence? Okay, many people would say, oh, noble truth, right? Many people would say that, which is a fair guess, I have to admit. It's not very bad at all, actually. But what the Buddha says here is the essence. This is actually a sidetrack from harmony, but it's so interesting. We have to touch on that, right? What is the essence of the Buddha teaching? This could be life and death issue for most of us. What are we going to practice? What are we going to do? It's a really, really important thing. So what is that essence of the Buddha's teachings? And the Buddha says the essence of the Buddha's teaching, and this is something you would never have heard about before, probably. It is something called the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas. How many of you here have heard about the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas? Those of you who were in my retreat are not allowed to raise your hand because you know what's going on already. How many of you heard about those? You see, nobody's even in the hand, right? And this is, the Buddha says, this is the essence of my teaching. This is what you should remember. This is what you should recite together so it lasts for a long time for the happiness and benefit of humankind, a long time into the future. These are the things you should practice and understand and penetrate. But when you teach them, it comes from personal experience rather than coming just from intellectual knowledge or whatever. What are these 37? And basically what they are all those practical things that the Buddha touches upon and teaches in the suttas. All the things that we're supposed to do on the Buddhist path. And basically it comes down to the Noble Eightfold Path. But if you want to know the other ones, Noble Eightfold Path is on the 8th of these 37. It is things like the 5 spiritual faculties that you may have heard about, right? Victor nods in agreement over there. He knows all these things already. I don't have to ask him. But so, 5 spiritual faculties, the 7 factors of awakening, the 4 foundations. I don't like foundations. The 4 applications of mindfulness. Right now, we're coming into how to translate these things. Very interesting for me, but maybe not so interesting for everyone here. So I'll leave that aside for now. That is the core of the Buddhist teachings, the practical aspect of things. How we move from where we are now, how to end up as a fully awakened being down at the other end of the path. It's a pragmatic teaching, a practical teaching here. But what he also teaches in this Mahaparinibbana Sutta, it's a very interesting sutta where he lays down everything that it is required for the Sangha and for the lay community to move into the future. He knows that he's going to pass away here. He knows that the Sangha is going to feel empty, is going to feel, who are we going to rely on now when the Buddha has passed away here? So he knows that he has to lay down some ground rules for how to actually move from here and move forward into the future. And many of the things in the sutta are about how the monastics, how the Buddhists are to deal with life after the Buddha passes away. And one of the things that he talks about is the things that lead to growth in Buddhism and not to the decline of Buddhism. Right? Very interesting. Right? What is going to lead to growth in the future? What is going to lead to decline? And some of the things, 2 of the things that he talks about in there have to do with harmony. And what he says, the first one he says is, as Buddhists, when you belong to a group, wherever it is, and usually when we talk about Buddhism, we mean like a monastery somewhere, like, or we can maybe mean a Buddhist group by extension, like the BGF or something like that. One of the things he says is that we need to meet frequently. We need to have frequent meetings. Yeah, and when you have frequent meetings, that leads to the growth of Buddhism and not to the decline. And you can see why that is the case. If we don't have frequent meetings where we meet together and we talk about issues and we try to resolve the difference between us, if we don't have that, we end up drifting apart in different ways. The cohesion, the common vision of the Dhamma that we're supposed to have drifts away, and we no longer have a sense of cohesion in the community. We can no longer carry on together as a unified whole. So this idea of having frequent meetings is actually an important aspect of the Buddha's teachings. The next thing he says, and this is where really the idea of samadhi, of harmony comes in really powerfully. The Buddha says, when we have these meetings, these frequent meetings, we should assemble in harmony. We should discuss the matters in harmony, and then we should leave and depart in harmony afterwards, after the meeting is finished. And what is it? This is actually much more profound than it may seem straight away, because one of the meanings of the word harmony in Pali, this word samagga or samagi, is not just the idea that we work together in a kind and friendly way. That is part of it. But an interesting part of the idea of samagi and harmony is that we do things in unity. We come together. Everyone comes together. Everyone has a say. Everyone has an opportunity to express their opinion. And this is exactly how the monastic community works. The monastic community is all the monks within one monastery. They come together. And when they come together, everyone has to agree. And if everyone does not agree, you cannot go forward. Right? And sometimes when I say that, people say, what? That's impossible. How can you possibly ever get anything done if everybody has to agree? Everybody knows that's impossible, right? Do you agree it's impossible if everybody has to agree? That's what people think. It cannot do. It cannot. Forget it. We've got to do something more practical than that. But actually, there's something very beautiful about that. The idea that everybody has to agree to something. In the monastic Buddhism, it means that if somebody's going to ordain, every monk in that community has to agree on that ordination, right? If one monk says, no, I don't agree, ordination cannot go ahead. And there's something very beautiful about that. If all the decisions are made in unanimity, right? Everybody has to come together. There's something very powerful about that, because it means nobody feels left out. Nobody feels that the majority is overruling me. They're crushing me. My opinions don't matter. I know that this person is a bad person. I don't want them to ordain. But nobody's listening to me, right? You feel crushed. You feel like your opinion doesn't matter. Oh, it's such a terrible feeling when that happens. So the idea then is that when you want to make a decision in the Sangha, if one person agrees, you have to listen to them. Why do they have an objection? And if the objection is valid, of course you don't go ahead. If you think the objection is not valid, you have to try to bring them around. How can we find some kind of middle way, right? Middle way, really important Buddhist word. How can we find some middle way so everybody is kind of satisfied? And then we move forward with that. And in the last final analysis, if there is one person who is just stubborn because they like to be stubborn, right? They're kind of one of these difficult characters. There's always a few difficult characters around. I'm sure you have met those. Maybe. So then you say, in the final analysis, they say, well, the majority wants to go ahead. Would you please give up your opinion for the benefit of the majority? And then they say, maybe not so sure. Okay, then I go ahead. I'll go and do it for the sake of the majority. Yeah, and that is such a beautiful way of making decisions in life. I don't know, is that that's possible at the BGF? Is that possible at the BGF, Victor? Yes? Can? Okay, well, very positive. So this is the kind of idea. You have a very good leader here who has kind of this kind of idea. It's very, very nice. So it means that nobody feels a place. It means that you have harmony in the community because everyone is listened to. All opinions are taken into account. And you find this beautiful, beautiful middle way where everybody feels that kind of we are moving together in harmony. Yeah, so this is one of those beautiful ideas of harmony. The idea that everybody has a say. Everybody kind of gets on board, right? Everybody is taken seriously. If we go by majority decision, by so-called democracy. Democracy, as somebody has said, is the tyranny of the majority over the minority. Yeah, there's some truth to that. The minority sometimes feels suppressed when you have democratic institutions. Of course, this only works when you have small integrated communities, right? When you have like the EXCO at the BGF meeting together, then you can have these kind of decisions. In a large country or large organizations, it becomes very, very difficult. But it is one very beautiful way of doing things. And this was an advice that the Buddha gave. He gave it to the monks, but he also gave it to the Vajjayans. The Vajjayans was a republic to the north of the Ganges River. And actually, very interesting story how this actually came about. And the way this came about was that King Ajatasattu, who was the king of the Magadhan Empire or Magadhan Kingdom at that time, he says, I want to annihilate the Vajjayans. I want to destroy the Vajjayans. I want to make them into nothing, to pulverize the Vajjayans, right? Oh, so violent. It's really kind of, when you read the text, you think, oh, these kings, they have no restraint, right? And what is so funny, because this is actually part of the history of the expansion of the Magadhan Empire. You can see it in the suttas, and you see the expansion continuing through the suttas, and then you move into history in the future, and you see it. This is recorded in non-historical texts, that the Magadhan Empire suddenly is this enormous empire over the entire north of India. You can see the suttas, the development starting in the suttas, and then moving on into historical documents later on. You see the continuity, right? Suttas to history. And this is very beautiful because it makes you feel that these suttas that we have, they are real historical documents. These are not made up by some scallywag monk, right, in the past. Oh yeah, let's add a few things here, add a few things there. No, they are actually reliable. These things you can trust them. And once you can trust the historical data, remember, the historical data is not really all that significant, right? Who cares about history? What really matters in those things is the word of the Buddha. That is what matters. Yeah. History is not all very nice and fine, but for a Buddhist, it is the word of the Buddha that matters. So if they kept the historical details intact, then clearly they also kept the word of the Buddha intact. This is the way I think, right? So maybe, I don't know if you think I'm crazy, but this is the way I think about these things, because it shows you that there is some integrity to these texts. And that is what is so wonderful about them. And this is one of the ways of finding out which texts are early Buddhism and which ones are later Buddhism. I'm mostly interested in what the Buddha said. I'm not so interested in what other people say. Like me, right? Like what I say. Not so interesting, right? What the Buddha says, that's important. And yet we tend to listen to everyone else except for the Buddha sometimes. So when I have finished speaking today, I recommend you go back to those suttas, look up what I've said, and if I said anything wrong, then come back to me and complain afterwards. Okay? That is the right way to go about these things. So this Magadhan Empire, I'm talking about King Ajatasattu. I hope you're able to follow my train of thought here, because I'm kind of jumping a bit back and forth, but the King Ajatasattu, he then says, I'm going to annihilate these Vajrayans. The Magadhan Empire went up to the river Ganges. I don't know if you have the map of India in your head. Can you see India in your head? Okay, India, right? Like this, river Ganges here, right? So you see India in your head. And you can think of the Magadhan Empire south of India. South of the river Ganges. And then north of the river Ganges, you find the Vajrayan kingdom above there. And then King Ajatasattu says, these are the people I want to annihilate. And then he says to his main ministry, who was a Brahmin called Vasakara, and he says to Vasakara, go to the Buddha, tell him that I want to annihilate these Vajrayans, and see what the Buddha says. What do you think about that? That usually, you go to the Buddha to ask for spiritual advice, right? You say, oh, tell me, how do I practice kindness? How do I practice meditation? That's usually why we go to the Buddha. He goes to the Buddha to ask, how can I be for the Vajrayans? How can I annihilate them? It's kind of weird, isn't it? But anyway, what the Buddha says, which is really nice, the Buddha then this Vasakara goes to the Buddha, and the Buddha tells him that these Vajrayans are very, very strong, and they are very strong for these reasons. And these are the reasons I was just telling you. They have frequent assemblies. They meet in harmony and in unity. Right? That is why they are so strong. So the Buddha is trying to say to this Brahmin, it doesn't work, of course, because ordinary people, they're kings, they are violent, they want more territory, they never get enough of territory, right? If they can have more, they will have more. That's just the nature of human beings. We're all like that. Not just kings, it's just the nature of craving itself. So he tells them, and these are the things that he says. They meet in harmony, they meet often. And there's five more things that he says. I'm not going to talk about those now, because it's going to take all day. How long have we got? Only till 11, right? Not till 11 tonight, but 11 this morning. So for that reason, we're going to have to keep it kind of reasonable. So these are the things that make the Vajrayan kingdom stronger. And if it makes the Vajrayan kingdom strong, imagine how strong it makes Buddhist organizations, like the BGF, like the BSWA in Perth, like any Buddhist organization, like the Sangha, like anywhere else. It makes us strong, it makes us powerful, it makes us united, it makes us speak with a united voice, it makes us have more kind of impact on society around us when we come from these things. We come from this with kindness, sensitivity to the environment, and all of this good aspect that we bring to that. So that is the Vajrayans and how they, why they were so strong. And of course then Vasakara, he thinks, oh yeah, this is a good point that the Buddha is mentioning, right? The only way we're going to beat these Vajrayans. The Buddha wants to kind of dissuade him, that no, don't invade the Vajrayans, they are so strong. But he kind of, the human mind thinks, oh yeah, good point, right? So now the only way we can beat the Vajrayans is by creating disharmony inside of them, right? Getting friend to fight with friend and kind of destroy the Vajrayans from inside, right? This is how people think. You get this wonderful advice from the Buddha, you take it completely the wrong way and use it for violence instead. It's terrible, isn't it? Such is the world sometimes. There's one more advice that the Buddha gives to Vasakara, and he says that one of the things the Vajrayans are doing, I told them they should always make sure that the arahants in the world are welcome to your country, and that when they come, you look after them properly. Right? So, and this is one of those very important things, and this is says the same thing to the Sangha later on. Whenever you have a Buddhist community, and you have a spiritual people who are attained, who know what they're talking about. We don't know who the arahants are, that's very hard to know, but we have some idea of who are the people who are well practiced and who have gone the long way on the path. We have some idea about that, just by judging them from outside. Invite those people, bring them in, use them as part of the community, because that means you have somewhere to go if you need to ask for advice. Right? The arahants in the world, they're the ones who understand the difference between defilements and purity of the mind. They're the ones who understand it between happiness and suffering. and they also understand the path to move towards happiness and away from suffering, both in the larger ideas of society as a whole and also on an individual basis. So make sure that you have those spiritual people around. This is one of the reasons why I always try to also hang around monks who I feel are much more, you know, long, long way further on the path than I am, because I know that it has a good influence on me. That's why I like to hang out with the Buddha. Yeah. How do you hang out with the Buddha? You read the suttas, right? When you read the suttas, you're literally hanging out with the Buddha. Whoa, wow, it's so nice to be with the Buddha. Thank you, Buddha, for teaching me all these beautiful teachings. I'm not saying this just for to be funny or whatever. I'm saying it because remember that when the Buddha was giving these teachings 2,500 years ago, he knew that the wheel of the Dhamma was going to keep on rolling for a long time into the future. Because he knew that. He knew that he would have to phrase the Dhamma in such a way that it was valid across cultures and across time. So when he was giving this teaching 2,500 years ago, he would think in 2017 on the, 8th of May in KL, right? At the BGF, there will be a group of people sitting together. I've got to phrase my teaching in such a way that these people all understand what I'm talking about. Right? And it's not really a joke, because it is actually, for the Buddha, it would have been very real, the understanding that he has to phrase his teaching in universal ways so everybody can understand what he's talking about. So he is teaching you, right? You are his disciple. He's thinking about each one of us when he gave these teachings. So when you do open the sutta, it is not theoretical that he's teaching you. He is actually teaching you. He's thinking about each one of us. So remember that, because it makes the suttas far more personal than normally the way we take them. We think of this as some ancient thing that was given in a different society. Yeah, yeah, interesting, but, you know, better to listen to the contemporary teachers, right? But actually, no, these are meant for us. They are meant for everyone. If you are a human being, if you have the standard things that human beings have, what you need to be a human being? Okay, if you have a mind, right, and you have a body, that's roughly what it takes to be a human being. If you have those two things, then the Buddha is speaking to you. If you don't have a mind, it means you are a zombie, right? Any zombies in here? If you are a zombie, the Buddha is not teaching you, so maybe best if you leave at this moment. Any zombies? No zombies? Okay, good. Maybe that's a good thing, we don't have any zombies in here. It's too scary if you have zombies. Oh. So zombies do not count. Apart from that, everybody else is included in this Buddhist teaching. So, and this is the power of having that access to the people who are already a long way on the path, the Buddhas, the Arahants, the Aryas, and all of these people, because they can show us the way, give a sense of the harmony to the community here. So use those people, right? If you have disagreements or whatever, go to some of these people and ask them for advice. Have like some either official or unofficial spiritual advisors to your community that you can go to and you can ask for advice if there's disagreement. It's very useful to actually have these things. And most of the communities that I know about, they have some kind of spiritual advisor. Everybody disagrees. They go to this advisor, okay, please sort everything out for us, right? It's really unfair. That's why Ajahn Brahm is always complaining. He goes, oh, everybody's coming to him to ask him about the problems and have to sort everything out. This is what happens sometimes. So these are some of the things to make the community stronger. And some of the things that you can do here at the BGF, and it will have ramifications for the whole of society far outside of the BGF, and also to people outside. And one of the ways of creating this harmony, because often it is very difficult, egos get in the way, personalities get in the way, so we need some guidelines for how to actually be able to work together like that, in unity, so that we can kind of take each other's ideas into account and we can kind of move forward with that. So what are some of those ideas that we can use? How long am I supposed to talk? 11 o'clock, is that right? Yeah? Okay, 11 o'clock, okay. I'll try to keep an eye on the watch over there so we don't go too far. So otherwise, please stop me as we go along. So, what are these things? And one of the very nice similes that many of you probably have heard before that is found in this little book called the Udana. The Udana is one of the books of the Pali Suttas. And in there, there's a very nice simile of the blind men and the elephant. Have you heard that one? Probably many of you have, because that's quite a famous one, right? And the idea of the simile of the blind man and the elephant is that this is a kind of a, the king wants to show how disharmony happens or something like that. And then he gets all these blind men and an elephant, puts the elephant in the middle and seven blind men around this elephant. And now he says to the blind men, okay, feel this thing in front of you. I'm not going to tell you what it is. And you tell me afterwards what you think it is, right? So one blind man, okay, he grabs hold of the trunk, okay, trunk. But it's a snake, right? This thing is a snake. Another one grabs hold of the tusk. Oh, it's not a snake. It's a pole, right? It's obviously a pole. It's nothing to do with a snake. It's rigid and that sort of thing. Another one grasps hold of the ear. Oh, it's not. What do you mean? It's a pole. You must be joking. It's a big fan, right? It's flapping around like a fan. That's what it is. Another one grasped hold of the tail. What do you mean? It's a fan. It's a whisk. Anybody can feel that it is a whisk. One person grabs hold of the leg. It's a pole. Another one, the head. It's like a jar, right? And so it goes. And the last one, I think, gets hold of the body. No, it's a big rock, right? A really, really heavy rock is what the last one says. And then the story is that they argue and they fight, right? And they kind of end up in a real big trouble. And this was the way the king showed his minister how arguing happens. And this is kind of the story behind that. And it is a very useful story to keep in mind. Because what it shows us, each one of these people was feeling the same elephant, but each one came back with very different information. And this is what life is like. Life is like that. We all come from different conditioning, different background, right? Every one of us, even though you've grown up in the same city, in the same country, with perhaps the same religion, we have enough differences in our background that we see the world in different ways. So sometimes, remember that. There is no absolute right way of seeing the world. There's just different perspectives very often. And of course, the idea here, one of those interesting things about this story, is that if all those blind men had come together and discussed the differences, then they would have been able to describe that elephant in a fairly good way. And this is often what life is like. If we come together and we look at our differences, look at our different ways of looking at the particular situation, when we put it all together, then often we come at better solutions than if we do things individually. Often the group intelligence is far more than the individual intelligence. That reminds me, maybe group intelligence is better. Maybe what we should, Dhamma talk in the future. Everybody should talk maybe. Huh? Yeah, maybe that wouldn't work so well. But maybe, if you had all the kind of the people's ideas together and we write it all out, maybe we have a really nice Dhamma talk. That would be interesting. Maybe we should try that one of these days. Huh? So that is one way of doing it. Remember, and that gives you a sense of humility. It gives you a sense of not having too much ego, or kind of thinking that your opinion is everything, is the be-all and end-all, and everyone else is just fools, right? Because you have seen it right. It's such a part of human nature to think that we are right. It has to be like that. We have to think that we are right, because you can only see things from your perspective. But when you remember the story of the elephant and the seven blind men, you realize that it's good to have a sense of humility, because the reality is often much broader than what we can see for ourselves. This is one aspect of this idea of harmony, one way of dealing with it so that we reduce the problems. Another one that I was teaching on the retreat that we had recently, I told the retreat that I was giving them a preview of the talk I was going to give here, so it's going to be really boring for those of you on the retreat. Right? You're going to hear exactly the same thing again. But one of the really nice places that Buddha talks about this in the suttas, he talks about what is called the six Saraniya Dhammas, the six factors that lead to cohesion and unity in the community, right? Especially talking to the monks. But of course, this also is equally valid for anyone who wants to create harmony within the BGF, within the family. Yeah, family also very important, that harmony, and also within the broader society as such. And these Saraniya Dhammas, the very first one, and it's very obvious when you hear this thing, right? You're going to think, I knew that already. Why are you telling me this? I don't really want to hear that. The point is, we know it, but we don't know it. Like so many things on the Buddhist path, we think we know these things, but it hasn't really sunk in a deep way. And that is why we need to hear them again and again and again. And as you hear them again and again and again, what happens then? You get brainwashed, right? The question, are you ready to get brainwashed? That's really the question. If you're ready to get brainwashed, then you might have harmony in the community. Otherwise, it might be difficult. So brainwashing is a very important part of Buddhism. So are you ready for that? Scary, right? Oh, if I had known this is my Buddha teaching, I would be out of here a long time ago. But this is the whole point. Remember that regardless of what happens, you get brainwashed anyway. There's no such thing as being independent of phenomena outside of us. In a sense, we are the sum total of all the things that have worked on us through so many eons, so many lifetimes, and also the thing in this lifetime. Right? When I come to KL and I meet you, all of you, you like your own food, like noodles, that kind of thing. I don't mind noodles myself, but I prefer things like Norwegian food, right? Potatoes and fish and that kind of stuff. Why is that? Different conditioning, right? That's the only reason. I used to eat that since I was a tiny little kid, and you used to eat noodles since you was a tiny little kid. So that's why we're different. Yeah. It's all about conditioning. And because it is all about conditioning, it means that we are brainwashed regardless. We have no choice but to be brainwashed. We are already brainwashed. Now, what you have to do is to make sure you get the right kind of brainwashing. The right brand of soap, right? A good washing machine. And then you are in business. Yeah. So this is the important point. Brainwashing is going to happen regardless. You just got to choose the right brainwashing. So now, are you ready to brainwash now? Yeah? Now it makes more sense, right? The Buddha's brainwashing is the good brainwashing. It's the brainwashing that leads to happiness. It leads to contentment. It leads to a reduction in suffering and more happiness in the world. That's why it is so good. So we have to allow ourselves to be as much brainwashed as possible. And the way to do that is, of course, to take in the Dhamma, to have a continuous influx of Dhamma teachings into our lives so we don't forget the essentials of what the Buddhist life is about. It's so easy in ordinary life to forget these things because we are so busy, so many things happening, so much stress and all these kind of things. It's everywhere in the world, right? Stress. The only place where there is no stress is monastic life. Oh, chill, right? Relax. This is this is marketing for the monastic life. And this is kind of the point. We need that input all the time. Otherwise, we forget it. And that is a beautiful way of brainwashing ourselves to remember the essentials of life. Kindness, goodness of heart, how we speak to others, how we act to others. This is the foundation of all Buddhist practice, and everything else comes from that. And that is why these Saraniya Dhammas, the very first one, is to treat the people around us, in the community around us, with actions of metta, loving kindness, right? This is the first one. And when you do treat the people around you in the BDF, in your family, in wider society, whatever it is, when you treat people with metta, that is where this harmony starts to arise. Because when everybody treats each other with kindness, it means that we are dear to each other. How can somebody who treats you with kindness not be dear to you? Automatically you feel endeared by somebody who's kind to you, right? If somebody says something nice, you think, oh, that's my friend, right? This is how it is. Somebody says something nasty, you don't have anything to do with them. So how we treat each other is so fundamental for whether we have harmony in the community or not. And what is interesting, what the Buddha says here, he says that this metta should first and foremost be with your sabrahmacharyas. The sabrahmacharya in the suttas means your fellow monastics, really, right? So your fellow monastics, that is really where the metta should be first of all. You should be kind to your fellow monastics. And maybe that seems unfair, right? Maybe that means I can be mean to you because you're not my fellow monastics. It doesn't really mean that at all, of course. What it means is that if you have harmony with the community that is closest to you, right, your fellow monastics, I live in Bodhinyana Monastery, we have about 23, 24 monks, something like that. If we have harmony within that community, that is the most important harmony for your spiritual practice to be successful. Because when you have harmony there, it means that those people who are closest to you, you have harmony there, and then you go back to your kuti, you meditate, and your meditation is nice and peaceful as a consequence. And it's exactly the same thing in lay life as well. The people who are closest to you, that is the place where it is most important to have harmony. Within the family, right? Make sure you do the very utmost to have a degree of harmony within the family. Not just the kind of the core family, but also the extended family. Because if you haven't got harmony there, you have not got the foundation to really be able to practice these Buddha's teachings. So you do your very best. You put in extra effort to have harmony within the family. And of course, then the second level out from that is like your spiritual community. Maybe the BGF. I don't know how often you come to the BGF, but if you come here quite regularly and you consider this your like your spiritual home or whatever, have harmony within the BGF community as well. These are the core things, because these are the things that are closest to us. If you're able to have harmony there, it's easy to have harmony with the rest of the world. If you're able to have harmony with those people who are closest to you, everything else tends to fall into place. It's so easy for me to be have harmony with you guys, right? So easy. I only see you once a year. How can I have no opportunity to argue with you at all? But my fellow monastics, I see them every blooming day, right? Whoa, too much. And I see all the small faults. I see all the small problems. Oh, they are so irritating. Now, wait a minute. Are they really that irritating? Actually, they are really, really good people. So you look away from the small irritations and you look to the bigger picture instead. And then harmony starts to arise from that. So first of all, kind actions to the people around you. Then kind speech to those people. Same principle again. The family, the Buddhist community and everything else, right? You have harmony if you have metta in speech towards those people as well. And then the last one is metta in thought. You think kind thoughts to all these people as well. That is the hardest one, right? Always thinking kind thoughts, never having any kind of upset. Oh, this is really difficult. But of course, that is the crucial thing, because once your thinking mind falls into place and you start to have kind thoughts about others, everything else happens as a matter of course. If you're thinking, if your mind is in the right place, speech and action will also be right as a consequence. Yeah, so thinking about people with metta is so important. And the Buddha says, not only in open, not only when you are around people. Sometimes people are very kind when they're around people, but as soon as they turn their back, they kind of think, oh, I really hate that person, but you know, or gritting your teeth to kind of be kind in the presence, but then once you move away, it is not the same anymore. But it's important that we have integrity, that we have the same kindness whether we are in private or in public. When we have that degree of integrity, it has a very transforming effect, and that is when it becomes very powerful to have this Saraniya Dhamma, the harmony Dhamma. So how can we have kindness in mind always to the people around us? This is a tall order, right? People say, oh, cannot, too difficult. So, but how can we actually do this? And the surprising thing is, it is not as difficult as you might think. It is actually not that hard. It is all really about how we use our perceptions, how we use our thinking mind. If you use your thinking mind with wisdom, then it is actually not that hard to have a sense of kindness and compassion, even in the way you think and perceive the people around you. And the Buddha gives a very beautiful sutta about this, not a sutta I was teaching on this retreat. It's called the Agata Pativinaya Sutta, which some of my fellow monastics over there will know about, of course. As soon as I say the Pali word, oh yeah, I know that one. Because this is kind of how we communicate. Even if we can't speak the same language, we can mention the suttas. Everybody knows what's going on. That's really quite cool, actually. Anyway, so this what this sutta says is that whenever you feel upset with somebody, or whenever upset may be about to arise, you can see now it is coming, right? Sometimes you can feel that it's coming. So how can I now shift my attention, shift my perception, shift my way of thinking before it becomes a powerful force in my mind? Once the anger is there, once you feel ill will inside of you, it becomes a very powerful force, very, very hard to let go of it. So ideally, we pick it up before it becomes very powerful. So how do we do that? And it's actually incredibly simple. The reason why you're getting ill will, the reason why you're feeling angry with somebody is because you're focusing on their negative qualities. Right? So what we have to do is we have to learn to then shift our attention away from the negative qualities onto the positive qualities of that person instead. That's all we have to do. So how can we do that? How is that possible to do that, to shift our attention like that? And what you have to do is you have to train your perception, to train the way you think about people, and as you do that, this shifting becomes very easy. So when you come to the BGF, right, sometimes there will be a little bit of disharmony, sometimes people will irritate you a little bit and annoy you because of what they do or whatever. But remember, when you come here, you're coming into the presence of people who are really, really good people. Right? People wouldn't come here unless they had some aspiration to be kinder. They wouldn't come here unless they wanted, had some intention to do something good in the world. They wouldn't be here unless the motivation inside of them was positive in a certain way. That is why they are here. So it's a wonderful thing to come to a place like the BGF and to be in the company of people who deep down are really good. Really, at least they're trying to be good, right? Sometimes our habits and the way we're used to doing things, they get in the way for being kind. But deep down, everybody here wants to do what is right. And when you remember that, that you are in the presence of people who really are good somewhere deep inside, that can make you overcome this perception of the small little bad things in life. They are irrelevant. It's nothing. What matters is the big picture, that deep down they have good intentions. They want to do something for their own life and also for the life of people around them. Yeah, this is how you shift your perception. You have to remind yourself of this again and again and again. And as you do that, that perception becomes powerful. When you see anger rising, wow, swap it over to that other perception, seeing the good things in people. Yeah, this is how we do that. And this is how we do that within the family, how we do it within the Buddhist community, and how we do it sometimes even in the world at large. I have only got 1 minute left, okay. So this is what the Buddha says, and we can use this idea for almost anyone in our lives. What you find out is that the vast majority of people in the world, they have some good qualities, and we can learn to build those up and think, what a wonderful thing it is that this person has this beautiful quality in them. It is not given that people should have good qualities, and it is a marvelous thing in the world that people actually have these things. And then, what about the bad qualities? We have to learn to forgive those bad qualities, to let go of those. And the way the Buddha explained it, I'm going to tell this incredibly brief, really, really short. The way the Buddha explains this is that if somebody has a lot of bad qualities, then we should have compassion for that person. Because a person who has a lot of bad qualities, they are like a sick person. They are like a sick person in the world. The reason why they have bad qualities, it's not because they want to have those bad qualities, but because they have been conditioned to have those bad qualities. They don't know what they are doing. Bad qualities lead to your own suffering in the long run. Nobody wants to create suffering for themselves. The only reason why they're creating suffering for themselves is because they are blind, right? They are deluded. They have no idea what is going on. If they understood that they were creating suffering for themselves, they would change those habits. They are incapable of changing the habits. And that's why they do bad things in this world. Yeah. So what is that? It's kind of sad, isn't it? It's a foundation for having compassion for people when you understand that they have no idea what is going on. They're leaning in the wrong direction, creating suffering for themselves, living a life as if they are their own enemies. The only people in the world we want to create suffering for is our enemies. And in this case, you're creating suffering for yourself. You're acting like your own enemy, not like your own friend. What a terrible tragedy that is. And once you get that into your perception, your understanding how the world works, you can forgive anyone. It's a very, very powerful reflection, very, very powerful way of looking at things. And anyone in this world can be forgiven. Even the worst, terrible criminals, right? Like the kind of history has seen many, many criminals in history, people like, yeah, I don't need to mention them. You know who they are, the kind of mass murderers, all kind of that kind of stuff. And then, of course, then when we do that, when we act in this way, we look especially at the people around us, we see their good qualities, and we forgive their bad qualities. Wow, then harmony really starts to arise in the community, in the family, within the BGF, but also within society at large. We stop having this friction between each other because we know that we are all conditioned, regardless of background, regardless of religion, regardless of culture. Yeah. We are in many, many ways the same. And also, of course, we also have so much in common as human beings. We all have way, way, way more suffering than we would like in our lives. And that commonality, too, increases even further the idea of compassion between us. So that is my suggestion to you. Try some of these things and see if that can create more, even more harmony. I'm sure you are doing reasonably well already in the BGF. Been a successful organization for a long time, so you can't be doing too badly, right? So rejoice in that and then take it one step further and then see how things go from there. Okay, that is the talk this morning here. Okay, so Bobby, yeah? You tell me what to do because I don't know what to do. So.
So I'd like to invite Dr. Sri, Dr. Ibrahim for a speech short one. That was very good morning, everyone. I think we have a very beneficial talk by Achan Brahmali. We have been very fortunate to have Achan Brahmali for teaching, coming here to run a retreat. I think this is the longest that Achan Brahmali has done with us for BGF, and it has been very beneficial. It was an 8 days retreat broken into two parts. But if you don't have a chance to participate in the retreat, simply because it's working days and your leaves are kind of limited, we have actually placed them online. Now it is available both audiovisual. You go to YouTube, you can listen to the talk as well as the recorded talk itself. And this will be put actually, well, it is www, it's put through the world. And Achan Brahmali was saying that how for Achan Brahm's talk, 1 million hits just for one talk. And that's amazing. Can you imagine 1 million people listen to Achan Brahm? So that is the power of internet. And now we've actually moved into that because we have just acquired some new technology. Yeah, thanks. Yes. So we're very grateful that we have the presence of Achan Brahmali. Also to participate in this program that we're running, we're having what we call the 12 days of WhatsApp. This is a very special year this year as a form of thanksgiving for having completed this building and having paid all our, because this costs us 6.5 million. And it's a lay organization. You don't have resident monks. You don't have anybody that's really charismatic, influential, hyper-rich. We don't have that. So we have got to really work hard, put our shoulders to the wheel in order to earn that kind of money to pay for the building. The building is fully paid. So, thanksgiving. And also the other thing is that in relation to the talk that Achan Brahmali has given to us, we always need harmony. Harmony, there will be a disagreement in the way we go about it, but can we go about solving the disagreement, coming to a consensus, coming to agreement in order to move forward? And this is what we need to do within BGF, within the Buddhist community, because we have many Buddhist communities coming along and also within the country itself. Yeah. And also, we have 7 days of Mahasangha Kirtana. Some of you have been participating in the Sangha Kirtana. Today is going to be the 7th day. We normally do just 1 day, but BGF takes it to stretch it to 7 days, and this is a very highly meritorious action because later on we're going to have the Mahasangha Kirtana. And it is not just offering to one individual monk. You're offering to the whole community of members of the Sangha, not only the monk that is represented, seated down there, to the world, Sangha of the world, and also the Sanghas of the past, which also include the Buddha, and the Arya Sanghas of Moggallana, Sariputra, people like that, as well as the Sanghas of the future. So this is very meritorious. This morning you participated in the Pindapata, part of our Buddhist tradition of offering alms to the monk. And we have something very special in BGF this year. This is something we have not done for 17 years. The last time was 17 years ago in our new center. It's Section 19, which is no longer our center because we moved here. We had a relics exhibition. This year we're having a relics exhibition. There are 38 exhibits of Aryas, of the Buddha's remains. bodily remains in the areas, and they are actually on the second floor. But on one condition, before you go and have a look at that, if you have not seen the relics yet, you would have to go to level 1 because we have prepared a video. And from the video, then you really understand about the relic, how it comes to us, what the Buddha's advice to Ananda was, and Ajahn Brahmani was talking about the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, just as the Buddha was actually traveling 3 months. It was like a 3 month journey. As he was approaching Kushinara, where he would finally pass away, Ananda was asking the Blessed One, "Blessed One, can you tell us what can we do after you pass away with your body remains?" Eh? And the Buddha has given some advice, and in that video you will see that kind of advice, and you would also know how to approach the relics as you approach the relics. It's like having an audience with the king and all that. Eh? So it is essential that you go for the briefing, which is in the form of a video that we have actually prepared for you, and everybody has to do that. Even yesterday, there were chanting groups that came in. We have 12 hours of chanting by different groups, and the last 3 hours was given by the monks. And then, of course, we would have Wesak Eve and Wesak Day. And the relics exhibition will last up to Wesak Day. So starting from today, it's open for public viewing right up to Wesak Day. That falls on the 10th of May, and it will end at 5 p.m., and after which the relics will be taken out from public viewing. It would have to be returned to the source, and is no longer open to public viewing. So if you want, please tell your friends and relatives about it. Okay? Now, the other thing Ajahn Brahmani mentioned about when he was talking about the Vajjin and the Magadha and also Rajgir or Rajagaha, I'm actually planning to lead a pilgrimage to India. Right? There are some places available. And if you're really keen to go to India on a pilgrimage, please sign up. Please contact me or Sister Elaine, who's helping to take down the names. All right? We'll see if you can get sufficient numbers. Many groups are doing this. We have just done that last year. Very nice, very successful pilgrimage. People feel very inspired with that. So if you want to walk the path where the Buddha really traveled, where each of these places, we will try to recreate what happened. In fact, I remember as we were approaching the prison of Bimbisara, I was telling them the story about how Ajatasattu killed his father Bimbisara. And then just when the story ended, we were there at the prison where Bimbisara was actually killed by his son. So it was actually very dramatic, and you actually could feel what really happened 2,500 years ago. So if you're keen, please give your name, right? So these are the two things I have. Please, this is the opportunity for you to make reverence to the relics. The relics are the bodily remains of people, of Arya beings that have traveled the past before, and they are to inspire us in the same manner that we should also be putting our inner practice together. Yeah? And also, it is important for us to meet more often. We have been trying to get people to come and meet more often within BJF. That is for the strength of the community, for us to grow our Sangha, our lay Sangha together. Right. So with that, I would like to pass the microphone back to Brother P.G. Singh, who is the coordinator for this dinner party this morning. Thank you.
Alright, sorry. Okay, good. First of all, I'd like to thank this morning the Pita Pata was good, calm, very quiet. Even the children was very quiet. You enjoy it. Right? So that's the way we do Pita Pata. Okay, the next pro event will be the Mahasangikadana. Okay. For this one, this is the last one for this event. It's different from the previous one because this time the monk, the Mahasangha, okay, will go and collect the food. Okay. So yeah, the kapi is ready. So for those who would like to offer, you can go out. If not, they can stay here. After the monks have collected their food, they will come back here for the chanting and as well as the transfer sharing of merits. Okay, so you can stay here because you will go out for a while, pick up the food and come in. Okay?